Well, okay, it's July the 30th, Tuesday, about 9:15, and we're continuing with a interview with Professor William Hackton, Bill Hackton, that we had started a couple of weeks, or had been doing a couple of weeks earlier. And today we are going to talk about his time here at the School of Journalism at the University of Wisconsin, and particularly the 1960s and 70s, which were a period of important changes both in the school but also in the university as a whole. Perhaps we could go back and you could talk about when you arrived here at the university, a little bit of what the program was like, and then maybe talk a bit about some of the changes that came in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. The 1960s were a very crucial period, I think, and it was a period when Ralph Knapsiger was, although he'd been here about, I think since 49, but he, by that time he was really in a position to put into place all the things that he wanted to do. The PhD program was really just getting started, and so the whole thing was in the process of change, and I came in the fall of 1959 from Minnesota. I came ABD. I hadn't finished my dissertation, so I came as an instructor. And I spent that first year, I spent a lot of time in the Historical Society doing the content analysis on Sunday newspapers. And at the time I came, the enrollments were really still very small. And there really weren't, I think we were graduating about 35 students a year that got BAs in journalism, in the journalism degree, which was a separate degree within LMS, so that it was either the BA or BS, and so it was a separate degree within LMS, so that in graduations the director would always be there giving out the diplomas. And but the staff, as I may have mentioned, the staff was small. I mean, was small, but it was still fairly large for the number of students that we had. And journalism had not, well, the program here had always been fairly small in the number of students in journalism, and the big growth had not yet started, which really started in the 70s, or the end of the 60s, I guess, is when it really took off. And as I recall, you know, most of the students were news editorial sequence, and there were a few students in PR, in part because Scott Cutliffe's PR attracted.
And you had an advertising or a public relations sequence.
Yeah, that's right. You had the sequence, although it overlapped very heavily with journalism. Mm-hmm. And part of Scott's philosophy, which I think is still a good one, is that he thinks the best training for a PR person is to be well grounded in the basics of journalism, mm-hmm. so you can deal with the press and take that approach. And also, in advertising was comparatively small, but it was starting to grow. And advertising, it's interesting that advertising kind of fluctuates with economic times. Mm-hmm. You know, at times when times are hard, or when there's a lot of like social protests and so forth, in the 60s, there weren't many students in advertising. It wasn't a popular thing to do. But then when times, when economic times get better, it seems that that advertising enrollment expanded. You know, when business became more palatable or more attractive to students.
Well, the advertising sequence came about in the early 1950s, didn't it? Didn't it branch off from business?
Yeah, field? Yeah. But see, we only had most of that 60s, we only had one really full-time guy in advertising. It was Watt Dunn, very able person, who went on, and we couldn't hold on to him. But Watson Dunn, and then we had Harry Smith, who was really a business guy, a marketing person, who was half-time in journalism, half-time in the business school. And so he taught some of our classes. And we had courses where, we had some courses where there was open to both journalism students and mm-hmm. to the students.
What was the rationale of putting advertising in journalism? Because there are some people who might argue there's a conflict there between if you're an advertiser and you're getting funding from you know advertising mm-hmm. sources, that's a kind of corrupting influence on journalism.
Yeah,
how did it wind up in the journalism school?
Well, I think that I know when my course at Stanford back in the 40s, there was one advertising course. Mm-hmm. And part of the rationale was that somebody who's going into journalism ought to know about advertising because advertising is the economic basis for supporting newspapers, magazines, the print media in general, as well as broadcasting, and so you ought to understand, you have to have some understanding of it. And but then I think there was something coming into journalism was the idea that, you ought to be able to train more than just the editorial type of person, because in publications,
Okay, we're back up here. The tape stopped. We were talking about why advertising is in journalism and not elsewhere.
Yeah, well, also I think that just the idea of serving the wider range of people going into the mm-hmm. publications. Mm-hmm. And so advertising kind of worked its way in, although I think right at Wisconsin, too, there was right at that time, you could see that there was kind of a split as to... whether advertising should be in journalism or in the School of Business, and the thing of it is, advertising by being in the School of Journalism could be more directly related to the advertising needs of the news media, mm-hmm. whereas advertising in business was subsumed under marketing, so it was a part of marketing, whereas it tended to lose its identity with media institutions.
I suppose this may be part of the move of the school away from just being simply concerned with journalism to
yeah.
the mass communication
that's
part,
right.
which is somewhat
that's
broader
right.
than just
that's
journalism.
Right. And also, that's a good point. And also, it was increasingly seen that advertising and public relations were part of persuasive communication.
Mm-hmm.
And persuasive communication was part of the broader concern of mm-hmm. Mass communication, i.e. with propaganda and so forth. And And so that there was the rationale, the sort of the intellectual rationale there to because a lot of the communication researchers were interested in advertising problems, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you had that tradition as we talked earlier that came out of the wars, World War One, and World War Two, the role of propaganda and influence
and advertisers played a very
yeah,
crucial role.
That's
in
right,
that.
In both wars, and yeah. So that there was a good rationale for it. But on the other hand, you know. From the point of view of a strictly a professional journalism school, it seems to me that this continuing conflict, and you see it, and it's apparent today, that I think is that you can argue that today, for if you take the sort of the Bleier traditional role to journalism education, the rationale for a school of journalism is the role it plays in informing the public mm-hmm. about, and it's a role in the democratic process, and that's the reason it's in a university, and it's the reason it's important to be studied. Whereas advertising and public relations are activities that are not related to that directly to that role, you know, mm-hmm. and could just as well be offered in a school of business.
Yeah. I've been reading some of Bleier's stuff just recently, and he of course was back in the 20s and 30s was very concerned about the impact of advertising on the role of journalism
mm-hmm.
and its effort to inform the public. That it, I think he feared there was a corrupting influence
yeah.
there in terms of undermining the effort to provide public information. On the other hand, I've one of the most compelling arguments that I've heard about. Why advertising is not in business is that it exposes people who are in advertising to a liberal arts background,
yeah,
which
right.
in a sense they might not have ordinarily, and gives mm-hmm. them some sensitivity to how their profession fits into a larger, you know,
mm-hmm.
scheme, society.
Yeah, right. Those are good yeah. points too. Yeah. And But it still comes up today, you know, when you have these conflicts of people criticizing schools of journalism for not doing this and that, and because it's, they say too many of their students are in advertising or public relations. And at least in the Nashville day, there was that effort to try to keep it in proportion. You know, and it didn't want the advertising to get too big, because that was part of the thing, that that we sort of resisted efforts to add more faculty in advertising and used the part-time lectures and so forth. But then in time, the push came more and more to you know, you had more and more students. And part, one of the things that happened at Wisconsin was that this happened later in the 70s, business school became very popular as a after the student troubles and so forth. And,
yeah, I would imagine in the 60s that advertising would have been sort of out of
touch with the time, or out of sync with the time. That's true.
Yeah.
And also in those days, in the 60s, somebody with a BA degree could get a job. You know? Yeah. I mean, that's, there were plenty of jobs available, and whereas we got into the 70s, then the BA degree didn't, BA liberal arts degree didn't automatically translate into a job, whereas business was gathering momentum, and the business students were getting good jobs. And so, but I was going to say that one of the reasons that advertising expanded in Madison was the fact that the business school was just overwhelmed with students. And so, in a sense, journalism got some of the rejects, so the people who couldn't get into the business school, and which could, became increasingly restrictive on its enrollment policies, became a lot tougher on grade point average. So we, a lot of students we got in advertising in the 70s were students who couldn't get into business school and were primarily interested in business careers, and that may have affected the the student body. Then you had as a result of that, you had advertising students who did not want to take reporting. For instance, also at one time we required advertising students even take the newspaper editing course, because we felt that you know, writing headlines or editing copy was a kind of a skill that that certainly translated into advertising. And,
well, I would think if part of the rationale was to people who are going to be advertising in newspapers or other forms of media, that they should have some understanding of how those various media work.
Yeah, and that's right.
That's right. Probably a sound rationale. Well, then the expansion of the 60s, I gather, was not necessarily in the area of advertising, but it came in other areas like news and editorial and communication research.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. A lot of it came in the graduate area. The graduate area was becoming increasingly defined here, as it was in other places like Illinois and Michigan State and Stanford and the places that that were really the as a part of Blair's influence were the intellectual leaders in the field. And so
how do you account for the expansion in the graduate population in the 60s in mass communication and journalism?
Well, it was part of a I think it was part of a general expansion in the social sciences, which increasingly call themselves social sciences rather than social studies, and the techniques of quantitative research or behavioral science was going all through the social sciences, and in psychology, political science, even history to a certain extent. Like they were doing some things in history, and social psych and so forth. We're all dealing with behavioral science approach, and of course a lot of the literature of mass communication of Schramm and so forth came out of those same fields, you know, that came out of that. This was a very exciting time, you know, exciting time for behavioral research and as well as quantitative research, and it was a period of great optimism that it was only a matter of time before the social sciences would be just as pure and scientific as physics or chemistry, that didn't turn out to be the case. But there was a great optimism that was coming. So it was an exciting thing to get into, and there were jobs, you know, and there were jobs. During the 60s, of course, were the go-go years as far as universities. Universities were expanding, And so there were jobs opening up in the, not only journalism departments, but in you're getting more and more sort of journalism and communication programs. So there were jobs and opportunities. It was, you know, in a lot of ways, it was really a very exciting time, but even if you weren't directly involved in it.
I would imagine that there was a period there, too, of where funding for research for university work was plentiful. I mean, this, I guess, what comes out of the Cold War environment and the post-Sputnik period, and then you do have also the GI Bill, which was available for people that was still there.
Although the GI Bill had pretty well run its course by that time, but there were still filled with people, a few people around. But you're right. Here at Wisconsin, for instance, the university got a big Ford grant, Ford Foundation grant, and this was the time, and this was reflected the whole Cold War approach. There's interest in area studies. That was something. Mm-hmm. And area studies were related to U.S. influence abroad and U.S. participation in the newly developing nations and in the competition with the Soviet Union for influence in these these nations. And so here at Wisconsin, primarily due to Harrington, had a big, was very
Fred
much
Harvey
attuned
Harrington.
Fred Harvey Harrington was very much attuned to all of this. And there were several, university received several, a big Ford Foundation grant, which that helped establish the African Studies program, and I think the Latin American studies, and I think some Soviet studies too. And so this, and I, as I mentioned earlier, I think I benefited from this too, and this was supporting graduate students, and so.
I think you mentioned last time that you really got into African, the area of African studies as a result of these.
That's changes. Right. That's right, and that was and that money was available because of the political, you know, the
political climate.
Yeah,
I find it kind of interesting now that we're in a period of retrenchment, and there's been an argument made that Cold War is over, and we don't have the GI Bill, and a lot of things have changed over the period, and yet at the same time, I don't really see a decline in enrollments. Yeah, the job opportunities may be less plentiful, and I'm you know there's a lot of the foundation for our modern research programs. It seems to me were put in the late in the 60s.
That's right. And also just to get back to our own program, that at that time we in the graduate program we expanded. There was an expansion in the quantitative area, which
well, was, that was the other thing.
Percy Tannenbaum came, and then Jack McLeod joined soon afterwards, and Bruce Wesley were all working in this area, and so we were getting graduate students and support, and there was funding for this sort of thing too. You know,
that was the other point I was going to make, is that it seems to me in the late 50s and the 60s there is a large growth in people who do quantitative research that type of, as opposed to qualitative research.
Yeah. The
expansion there, I suppose what the growth of groups like the ICA, I think, comes along, and I can't remember the exact date, but I think it's maybe late 60s, which in a sense is really focused towards that kind of research, and in some ways maybe the whole curriculum begins to change in journalism.
That's right, and you offered, there were courses, undergraduate courses that were being offered in these areas, and but it was more in the graduate area. But at the same time, a mention should be made at Wisconsin, due to Bud Nelson's influence in particular, graduate work in law and history were getting started, and also international. I was involved in international, and Ralph Nastergan, of course, had a long interest in international himself. So there were students that were that came out of international, of international backgrounds. But yet, you know, you could have a student interested in international, and his research method could be either historical, or legal, or it could be behavioral. You know, mm-hmm. the behavioral studies that.
When you first came here in '59, was international a distinct area of research for graduate study,
or it was not the way it is today? No, not really. Yeah. Ralph Napziger taught an undergraduate course on international communication, and was one of the. There really wasn't that much going on around it, but it was just coming to the fore during that time. Mm-hmm. And there was an international seminar, but I don't think the PhD students, the early PhD students, were particularly involved in that. They may have taken the seminar, but they weren't doing a thesis in that mm-hmm. in those areas. Mm-hmm. And, but it was just coming to the fore, and in part because other universities too, like Michigan State in particular, Michigan State got a lot of federal money, a lot of federal money to aid in developing nations and so forth. And people like Paul Deutschman and John McNally, who got his PhD there, and who mm-hmm. came back here as an international specialist.
John came back as Latin America was his area.
Yeah, that's right, and was fluent in Spanish and had done a lot of field research. And you're getting people who had done field research abroad mm-hmm. in these areas, and so...
John came to the faculty, what year do you remember?
It was only about 3 or 4 years after I came.
So it had been early 60s.
Early 60s, yeah. Certainly. Before
he had worked for Reuters, is that correct?
That's right. John had worked for Reuters in London and had worked for, I think he'd worked with AP in this country. He had media experience, and in many ways he was a lot like myself, and that we were both sort of in that Bleier-Napziger mold of...
Had he already, his area of Latin America, had he already done work in Latin
that's
America?
That's right, he had been in Latin America and spent time there, and he had learned Spanish, and uh-huh. And so that Latin America became an area of expertise for him, and so he brought that kind of expertise into mm-hmm. the program. And then when Ralph retired, which was in 65, John and I sort of jointly worked in the international area, mm-hmm. and we would take turns teaching the undergraduate course. Then I added a course. Ralph had the course on international communication, which focused on essentially on the European and the wire services and so mm-hmm. forth, the traditional areas. And then I started a course called Mass Media in Developing Nations, which tended to deal with the Third World and all these newly independent countries and what was going on in there. And there was a lot of interest in research and with writing was going on there. So Wilbur Schramm, for instance, got very much involved in mm-hmm. International communication in those years himself and wrote a couple of books that he wrote had a big influence on the growth of the field. Mm-hmm. So it was coming, you know, But this, you know, this was part of the 60s. It was just this great intellectual expansion of the field. And go back to Madison, Bud Nelson was teaching history students that were starting to deal with a lot of the mm-hmm. who were taking seminars in history, but were dealing with the colonial. He was always interested in 18th century press, colonial mm-hmm. press, and so. Some very good students were going through there, like Dwight Teeter and John Stevens, and Marianne Udella Smith, and others mm-hmm. that were being trained as historians. But a lot of Bud had this dual interest in both history and law, so they were taking his law seminar as well, mm-hmm. and I was involved in this to a certain extent, teaching the undergraduate law course. I didn't do much in the. I did some in the seminar, but then when African area sort of took over. So we were, you know, Wisconsin at that time was turning out PhDs in the history of the law area who were helping to define the field mm-hmm. and for others, and they went to other universities. Mm-hmm. As a result of that, Don Shaw was another, was a graduate student. Early graduate student mm-hmm. here.
He was in North Carolina, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then later, people like Dave Nord, and these were, you know, these people were well trained as historians. They weren't just journalism professors who took a little history, but you know, it's that you know these people and their work. That so And a lot of them did a lot of they did a lot of seminar work in the history department. And this was another thing that was important about Wisconsin in those days. I think it's still true, but it was certainly true then. It was unusual in the field that our graduate students took a lot of their coursework, particularly seminars, in other departments, and in law or but particularly history was a good example, and then of course in the social sciences, the behavior of people would be taking statistics and social psych courses and things like that, and as part of the backgrounds, so that they were very well prepared, you know. It's and some
Merrill Curdy?
No, not Merrill Curdy.
Merrill Jensen.
Merrill Jensen.
Yeah,
was particularly popular for seminars, and he had a very high regard. I know he had a very high regard for the journalism students who worked with him, such as Teeter and
Marianne
Udellis.
Yeah.
And so that was part of, and I think that and then of course the students that were being turned out in the behavioral area were outstanding as well. So
their roots tended to run into political science and sociology and psychology and those areas.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And political communication, and then of course Steve Chaffee came in about 1965, I think, and so that
well now let's
a
see.
Big input and,
Jack McLeod came in the early 60s, Steve Chaffee
about 65, uh-huh. I think 64, 65, and it's interesting that the sort of the connections that well Jack had been an undergraduate here, mm-hmm. and then went did his PhD work. I forget where he did his master's. He may have got a master's here, but certainly his PhD was from Michigan, mm-hmm. and so he brought I think his PhD was in sociology in Michigan. But anyway, he brought the expertise and influence of that. And Michigan at that time was, of course, getting involved in the social science areas, was getting involved in.
John McNally did his undergraduate work here, didn't he?
That's right.
That's what I thought. I remember you seeing him with the picture on the Cardinal back in during World War II.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was an editor of the Cardinal.
Yeah.
But Steve Chaffee, for instance, had come from California. He and I both had been to UCLA in the master's program, although he was several years later. But he got he didn't have any prior Wisconsin connections, and but he did have a PhD at Stanford under Bush, mm-hmm. and Bush had urged him. I mean, had certainly highly recommended him, and I think was pleased that he came to Wisconsin.
I would say that probably Steve and Jack were very prolific researchers. I would imagine they made a huge.
Yeah.
Impact in
defining
the graduate direction of graduate research here.
That's right. They turned out a lot over the years between the two of them, and they were often together. They were a very closely working team in those years, so that a lot of their students, they turned out a lot of students that have spread out through the field and have had a big influence. Mm-hmm.
Now, Steve came here around 65, and then Bud Nelson became the director after Ralph Nassiger.
Yeah, that's right.
Retired.
Yeah.
And this was around 1966, if I have my date.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Or 67. Let's see, Bud. I know Bud was director for 9 years, and so it must have been 66 that he.
Could you talk a little bit about Bud and his time as director and what you saw as developments in the school and what happened during that period. Now this is a period, of course, late 60s, I suspect, when there's a tremendous amount of campus turmoil and the Vietnam, anti-Vietnam War, and the civil rights movement and a whole range of things that are happening
That are occurring. That's right. And that was a rough time to be an administrator.
Well, I would think so, yes.
Yeah, and, but Bud handled it very well. For one thing, Bud, at the time he took over, of course, was very much in tune with everything Ralph Nassiger had done, so he was really, Bud was really continuing, there was no great sharp change of directions, but he was continuing and the things that Bud, that Ralph had done, and in a lot of ways was more efficient. Ralph was retired at 70, and I think there was certain slowing down that took place. And he was still very able. Ralph was very able as an administrator right up to the end, and was highly regarded in the university. But I think as a teacher and as a graduate instructor, I think he was sort of losing his edge a little bit. But anyway, but Bud really, I think there was sort of an increased tempo when Bud came in, and Bud became very active in AEJ at that time too, and was helping to reorganize AEJ. But he was,
how did, if I can interrupt just a second, how did the school come to select Bud as director, or did he express an interest in the job?
Well, I think he was kind of. I think he was sort of seen as an heir apparent, for something. Ralph certainly favored him, this is pretty much the. In those days, there wasn't as much faculty governance as there was later. I don't remember we ever voted on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it was the dean's choice. Mm-hmm. The dean makes the choice, in later times, at least by the time I became director, there was kind of a vote in the faculty first as to whether.
So your directorship was maybe the first one where there was a faculty vote on.
I think so. Because I certainly don't really. There was a competition between Bud and Cutliff, and that's kind of an interesting story.
and
Scott very much wanted the job, mm-hmm. Ralph's choice was very much Bud, mm-hmm. Scott did a lot of maneuvering and so forth, including if I recall correctly, he did a lot of work among the weekly newspaper editors, who were kind of important in the school because they were kind of a close association then, and trying to get those people to support his candidacy, mm-hmm. Which I think it kind of backfired on him, and I think there was a resentment that person should try to get the media to try to influence what would be essentially an academic, mm-hmm. academic appointment. Mm-hmm. But there was a feeling that Scott was disappointed that he didn't get the job. But in any case, Bud was Ralph's choice, and then the dean at the time, which was Leon Epstein, I think, was the dean at the time that Bud became director, and was the one who. Made the appointment, mm-hmm. It was essentially ratifying what Ralph had wanted, mm-hmm. So Bud had to deal with the whole problem of the student protests and so forth, which got pretty wild in those days. Mm-hmm. But one thing, and graduate students were very very much involved in the student protests, and one thing that's sort of interesting that I was in retrospect about all those wild years. Was the fact that the journalism students, particularly, and journalism faculty, were not nearly as radicalized as, say, political science or history, or other departments of the younger faculty were not nearly as radicalized.
Now, how do you account for that?
Well, my feeling was that there were, in the journalism faculty, a lot of the people had been out in the real world, mm-hmm. and had worked on newspapers or. Advertising or other kind of media, and so they had a little broader perspective, and were not as much taken in by the whole psychology of the mm-hmm. overturning the world, remaking the world, and whereas a lot of the junior faculty in the other departments, particularly history, sociology, political science, were just they were really kind of crazy at that time, But also, one other point was that, this was also reflected in the graduate students. Our graduate students were much more, less committed and less involved. In part, there again, because a lot of the graduate students had worked outside of the academia. A lot of the problem in the student protests was you had students. The graduate students and the faculty were people who had never been outside the university, mm-hmm. and they were very susceptible and in a lot of ways kind of naive, politically naive. They really, mm-hmm. They thought they could change the world by revamping the university, and that the university had to be involved in fighting the Vietnam War, for instance. Mm-hmm.
I've often wondered, you know, there is a whole generation now of faculty who came of age during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Now, I'm one of them, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went to graduate school during that period.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, how many people actually went into graduate work, how that was influenced by Vietnam. And one's attitudes about research and so forth may have been formed during that period. And what you're saying here is that journalism and graduate research in journalism and mass communication tended to be maybe more conservative in terms of its reaction to these kinds of changes.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Is that true of the whole field, do you think, or just your
I think it was true of the field, with a few exceptions. In the all through the sort of the radicalization of the curriculum and so forth that took place, as a result of the late 60s. I saw it first in African studies.
Mm-hmm.
I was sort of involved in, because of my interest in Africa, I was sort of involved in the African Studies Association, there you had, I remember Phil Curtin, the historian, was talking about how in the African Studies Association, it had not one but two sort of far left kinds of groups that were approaching, a very radicalized view of history. Mm-hmm. Well, nothing comparable was taking place in journalism education or there was a little bit among it really came from Europeans, from the European side, a few in the U.S., Herb Schiller and Dallas Smythe and so forth, but these are kind of fringe figures that were never particularly active in AJA.
I know in history you had a kind of new left group that were, of course, quite critical of old traditional liberals, liberal approach to writing history, and they in some ways, I think, gained a good deal of influence in the 60s.
That's right. Well, one of the things that happened, and it certainly happened throughout the university, was sort of what it did to the whole grading system, the standards of before the student protests, grades meant something, and people flunked courses, and there were A's and...
And a C wasn't such a bad thing.
That's right, the gentleman's C, the gentleman's C. And then, one of the things that was happening in the 60s, is part of the protest that these people would give everybody A's.
Mm-hmm. I suppose
the whole idea of grading became under...
Well, I suppose there was a certain...
A form of oppression,
And I think it also, there's some pressure about you didn't want to send somebody off to the draft, plunking them out of school or whatever.
Yeah, that's one of the great ironies of that period, that was apparent to people my generation who've been in World War II, in World War II where everybody went, And I think that there was not a single Harvard graduate in the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. There's something comparable to that, And of course I think it was one of the great mistakes of the government during the war that they did not graft. It was very easy for a college student to avoid the war, so it became the poor guys went to the war, and the educated people were able by one way or another. It wasn't just Bill Clinton, but it was most of a generation. It was very easy to find one way or another to not go to war. But it was an unpopular war too, of course.
Some of the critiques I've been reading recently of various authors suggest that mass communication research from the end of World War II on, that a lot of the researchers, in a sense, became involved in the Cold War, and a lot of the research questions, in a sense, were defined by government concerns. And I suppose maybe also if advertising was coming to have a larger role, would that have had an impact in also determining the direction of mass communication research during this period, more so than, say, history or political science or some of the other?
Well, I don't think it would be any more than, say, political science, because the same kind of funding things were available. I was close to political science because it was my minor in Minnesota, and I was, and, mm-hmm. uh, a lot of my kind of research was sort of had sort of political implications, the legal side as well as press-government relationship. But I think that a lot of the same kind of, the money, where the money comes, who provides the money, and it has a very definite influence on the direction the research goes. And, mm-hmm. and a lot of money was available, and to do research that even a lot of the certainly the overseas things and all the overseas kind of research had some kind of a connection to the broader political. Mm-hmm. Geopolitical concerns of the nation, and so journalism was not that different. But there was this great concern with, with aid in developing nations. With helping the third world modernize. That was a big part of the whole. And a lot of what SRAM did, and a lot of the stuff that was done at Michigan State and other places, Stanford, was related to this whole thing of how we can help third world modernize. Now that was not a particularly, that you can say that had Cold War implications, but it also was a certain, it was a way of trying to help the world, mm-hmm. and it was, the UN was in very good, UNESCO, a lot of UNESCO was a kind of a focus of this, a lot of the kind of research, SRAM and others, Ralph and others, worked with UNESCO and with, and in their mass communication area and mm-hmm. so forth. And so, there was certain kind of radical things, sort of things too. The land tenure center here on campus, which gets out of our area, but the people in ag journalism were involved in it, rural mm-hmm. sociology. These people were very much concerned with the real problem of how there had to be land reform if Latin America is ever going to break out of this mm-hmm. kind of a feudal society that was based on the church, mm-hmm. the military, and the great landowners. And so a lot of the research that went out of the land tenure set was fairly radical in the sense that it sort of got involved with the mm-hmm. With the revolutionaries in Latin America who were trying to turn the world upside down. That's another area. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier when we were talking about curriculum changes and the radicalization of curricula. Were there efforts in the school to change the curriculum during this period? And if so, what kinds of changes were proposed and what happened in that arena?
Well, one thing that was happening, that there was this big effort to get students on faculty committees, and it was all through the university. Mm-hmm. And so we were all doing that, that was, mm-hmm. and we were adding students to the various faculty committees, and so there was some student input, but at the time, a lot of us thought it was kind of crazy, why should the students waste their time sitting around with faculty members when they've got their own problems, their own lives to lead, and, but that happened for a while, and I suppose it had some influence, but I don't think the influence on the curriculum was very strong, But I think these sort of influences, in some ways, came later, when you had when the Vietnam generation moved higher up and, mm-hmm. and got into tenure positions mm-hmm. and so forth. That at least in our field, I don't think there's nothing that. And there again, I think that journalism education and communication research tended, at least for all through the 70s, tended not to be radicalized in the sense that perhaps some other places were doing that, mm-hmm. or this time. Mm-hmm.
Just to mention that the early 70s was when the school moved into Vilas Hall.
Yeah,
here.
Right.
I've heard various stories about Vilas Hall having been built to be siege-proof. There are all kinds of mythology that surrounds the building. Is there any truth to those rumors? Or
well, you could say that the construction that took place during that time, the Humanities Building, which was completed during that period, mm-hmm. the history, mm-hmm. the history and the art history and so forth, music art, and Vilas sort of reflect the sort of the siege mentality of mm-hmm. higher education. Although I think in the I think the plans were well drawn. In the case of both places, were drawn well before the radicalization took place. Certainly in the case of Humanities, which was built before us, before our building, and they must have been. Part of it was just taking advantage of sort of the new techniques of using cement and unfinished cement walls and so forth, and like in the classrooms in Humanities building, if you've seen them.
Well,
that's sort of
and the hostility to windows apparently.
Yeah, that's right.
Seems to be.
And you could you could defend the barricades with that. But it's interesting that the School of Journalism. Some people have felt that when we were in on we were in before we came here, we were just from the point of view of the history of the school. When I first came in 1959, we were in this old building. A chemical engineering building, I think, at one time, but it had gone through a lot of changes. A terrible old building, right where the Helen C. White Library and parking lot is. Well, at that time, we
were just talking about Vilas Hall, and I suppose Vilas Hall symbolizes, in some ways, the changes that were taking place in communication research, because it's a building that houses a TV station and radio stations. You had theater and comm arts, communication arts, and journalism and mass communication. Okay, communication arts and journalism and mass communication have been separate here at UW,
yeah.
Whereas at other schools they've kind of, in some ways, kind of been associated more closely.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about why that's so and how it came about?
I think that one of the reasons that they've stayed separate here is that both our departments have stayed within a College of Letters and Science, whereas in other schools, they often were brought together in a College of Communications, where the you had these two parallel fields: the journalism education that came up out of training people for journalism for news.
Okay,
and whereas. Whereas the Comm Arts came out of the speech department and the traditional speech and rhetoric and that sort of thing, and when we decided about 19 before we came over here to Vilas Hall, we decided we were going to change our name to School of Journalism and Mass Communication from strictly just journalism, and Comm Arts got very upset about that, because at that time they too were getting involved in communication studies, and one way or another, and and also they had people that they were interested in broadcasting, and they say broadcasting is an extension of speech, and so they had in broadcasting. They were teaching courses in broadcasting, and there was a lot of effort to try to separate the fields. We had the news aspect of broadcasting; they had the production and entertainment aspects of broadcasting. Mm-hmm. So the lines got pretty blurred when you started looking at things like FCC regulations and so on. And they had people in broadcasting, and there was some effort. Lee Dreyfus and Joe Ripley and Larry Lichty, three people in particular, that are all really could have been in our department, but they were in speech and. So we tried to keep separation, but there was inevitably an overlap. I mean, they had courses that were really quite similar to ours, and vice versa.
The change of our name from journalism to journalism and mass communication suggests a kind of broadening of intellectual, the arena in which, of interest. How did that come about? Do you remember?
Well, that was already being started around the country, and and there were departments. There was Michigan State, I think, never did have journalism in their time. It was College of Communications, and SRAM had used it at Illinois. So we were sort of getting in line with what was going on elsewhere, after we did that, we said a School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Increasingly around the country, schools of journalism were adding mass communication to their title. But when we proposed it here, I forget what speech was called, and I guess it was the Department of Speech.
Or maybe rhetoric. I'm not quite sure. Either.
But they also had theater. You know, they also had the theater in there. Mm-hmm. Speech and theater were in the same department, although theater later moved out. But they got upset, and so that's the time that they were concerned that we were taking over the field. And so that's when they changed their name to Communication Arts.
Now, what had been their name before? There was rhetoric.
Well, that's what
or
I was
speech, speech, speech or rhetoric.
I think it was speech and theater arts. It was the Department of Speech and Theater Arts.
So that suggested an expansion of their domain also.
They wanted to hold on to that.
Yeah.
They didn't want us to preempt the whole
area of communication.
So they became Communication Arts. And also, it's sort of an interesting footnote here, too, is that when the building was being started, when they came around to name of the building, there was an effort that was made to call it the Vitus Communication Arts Building. Mm-hmm. And we got unhappy about that because that was the name of their department. Mm-hmm. You know?
You just called it Vitus Communication Hall.
Vitus Communication Hall, to avoid that. But that was what, and that there again, it got our dander up just as there, you know.
Yeah.
So there's always been kind of a rivalry there. And of course they've had people not just in the broadcast right, but sort of in the areas of communication research, that like interpersonal communication, mm-hmm. and Marianne Ferguson and Joanne Kander, two examples mm-hmm. that I think are still active that were sort of coming up.
I
so
think
people
Marianne,
getting PhDs, yeah. for instance, at Michigan State and so forth, or Illinois, could come to their department or here. You know.
Yeah. You wanted to say a few words about Bud Nelson and trying to assess his leadership, and perhaps you could talk a little bit about what you see as his legacy as director.
Yeah, well, Bud, as I say, very much followed in the traditions of Ralph and Blyer, but he was one, you know, and he was very active in the AEJ and saw the AEJ as an important, and was active in the reorganization of AEJ into the divisions, and which it was getting big, but it was a real mess. And but the reorganization of the division, he had the committee reorganization into divisions, was very important in sort of establishing the research areas as well as teaching areas within mm-hmm. the field. But he saw it as and we did in the faculty in general saw AJ as a major scholarly influence in the field, and our graduate students. We were the first university where graduate students were actively giving papers, mm-hmm. and that soon was picked up by others. PhD students were giving papers at AJ.
This kind of started under Bud's leadership.
Yeah, that's right. I don't think there was much of it before Bud. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, but also the students of Jack and Steve and so forth were doing it, as well as the history and mm-hmm. other students. And so that, and but also Bud believed that was believed in accreditation. It was an important thing.
Now let's explore that a little bit. Why is accreditation important? What are the advantages of accreditation?
Well, one of the big advantages of accreditation is what it does for the field as a whole. To give it a historical perspective, that Blyer really provided the model of journalism education that became the dominant model, and that became the model of accreditation. Mm-hmm. And so, in a way, it was a device that enables schools that want to get into journalism to find out how you do it, you know, or what's the approved or the best way to approach it. And so that accreditation became an important tool to enable. And then during the 60s was a real rapid period of expansion. You know, everybody was going into journalism or communication. And so the accreditation program became a model that could be imposed on a new program to mm-hmm. show it how to do it. So that was important too. And it was also assumed, you know, and AJ became divided between the accredited schools and the non-accredited schools. And so you had two separate groups within AJ. And because all the accredited schools formed an association under the umbrella of AEJ, and so there was kind of an intellectual conflict between the schools who were not accredited, who didn't seek accredited, or were not able to be accredited, sort of followed their own path, and so that became kind of an intellectual struggle within the mm-hmm. within AEJ over a number of years, so there was a lot of kind of a rivalry between the two. But also another advantage of accreditation was the idea that my accreditation, somebody who was a student who wanted to go to a university would be able to find out. You know, you'd get a list of the accredited schools, this helps a student, high school counselors and so forth, the students who want to study journalism, to know where a good place to study journalism. And so that was, although I've often felt that was overrated. I mean, mm-hmm. students went to university, to a good university, and then they, mm-hmm. they studied journalism if they wanted to. But that was considered one of the reasons for accreditation as a way of forming potential students. You know, in the early, you know, when I was first here in '59, and all, you know, there really weren't that many students in journalism, and so there was a lot of recruiting that went on in high schools, mm-hmm. and to try to get students interested. You know, Wisconsin goes way back to, I guess it was under Hyde, that they used to have an annual visit. They used to have a day where high school journalism students were all invited to the campus for one day, mm-hmm. and they would show them around and encourage them to study journalism. And so that continued for a long time. I know a friend of mine in Indiana, when he was teaching there in the late 50s, I guess, early 60s, the journalism faculty went out and beat the bushes, you know, or mm-hmm. went and visited high schools all over the state of Indiana trying to encourage students to come to Bloomington and study journalism because, you know, they were short on students and uh-huh. they wanted to...
Recruiting practice, is that something that ended in the 60s when there was a big
Yeah, I think it certainly ended by 70s. The end of the 60s, yeah. by the 70s. Then it's the 70s, you know, that around 1970, before Watergate, a couple of years before Watergate, there was this sudden surge of journalism enrollment. Later, not too long after that, everybody said it was due to Watergate.
But it actually took place before
Watergate. It started before Watergate, yeah. and it was well established as a trend. It just became chic, you know. Yeah.
While we're on, I suppose there are maybe movies like All the President's Men maybe yeah. glamorized the profession
sure,
a little bit.
Sure.
I guess that has a little bit to do with the profession you go into is how it's perceived.
Yeah, right.
Back to accreditation. Accreditation. Does being accredited give a school some leverage, let's say, with the university if there are problems, let's say, in salary structure or in, you know, professional standards or whatever
yeah.
Within university administration that that are significant?
Sure. Well, I think that in most cases that's true. And I think for a student to lose accreditation is pretty bad PR, you know, mm-hmm. to be accredited and then to lose the accreditation, you become the local newspaper picks it up, you know, mm-hmm. they're unhappy, they're sort of suspicious of these guys teaching journalism anyway, they mm-hmm. don't know what the real world of newspapers are like and so forth. So there's a real problem there, but on the other hand, accreditation has the advantage of enabling the department or the school to have some leverage on its own administration. For instance, when you go through accreditation and you find there's certain shortcomings that come up, you know, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. faculty, you don't have enough faculty, or your facilities are poor, and if that is emphasized in the accreditation, and in the accreditation process, the accreditors always meet with the administrators, mm-hmm. administration, mm-hmm. and it's a chance for the department to let the administration know that, you know, our salaries are pretty miserable, you know, we really ought to have more salaries, and we also ought to have some mm-hmm. qualified people teaching law and history rather than just somebody that we just pick up, you know, mm-hmm. and so that's a way, so the administrators who are nervous about losing accreditation because it reflects badly on them will often accede to the request that way.
Well, when we got onto this topic, we were talking about Bud Nelson, and I assume that Bud, having talked with Bud, I know Bud was a very strong supporter of the process of accreditation.
Yeah.
And I'm gathered from talking to you that that's a theme that you also felt was very important.
Yeah. I wasn't as actively involved as Bud, but on the other hand, well, in the later years, certainly while I was director, number of schools, of Wisconsin is one, and Stanford and I think Minnesota and others, all began to have problems with accreditation. And that's another story, which is a more recent thing, but mm-hmm. I don't know if we want to go into it here. But it became a case where the accreditators began to impose upon schools like us standards that we really couldn't mm-hmm. justify for ourselves. And for instance, the idea they would not In the normal, just to go into it briefly, the average school that becomes accredited, the accreditation is often based upon the courses that are offered in the department, which they consider should not be more than, say, 20% or
right, yeah,
a limited percentage most of those schools don't offer much anyway, mm-hmm. and so the rest of the work, roughly two-thirds, should be in other liberal arts departments. Well, in Wisconsin, because of our bigger curriculum, the number of courses we offer, like the history of journalism or the international communication or theory of mass communication and a whole number of things, these are courses are equivalent to liberal arts courses that would be taught they would get elsewhere on the campus. To restrict our offerings in the same way you would restrict it. That became the basis for our
withdrawal. One of the issues certainly, and perhaps the solution there is to be a little more flexible, yeah. depending on the program as to whether when you apply a formula.
Yeah, that's right. And you had people that were very inflexible in this.
Yeah.
But one thing I should say, I'd like to get in here at this point, is that I think that one of the reasons, and it's an unfortunate thing, one of the reasons that Wisconsin's reputation has dropped sharply in recent years is because it is no longer in accreditation. Mm-hmm. It's an unfair reason, but it's true, you know, that because we're outside of it, Wisconsin, for instance, is not yet invited to conferences that are where you draw schools from the number of accredited schools, and it hurts. It has hurt Wisconsin's image, you know. Mm-hmm. And
when you speak about this, is getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. But the decline of Wisconsin, where do you see that in terms of what kinds of evidence suggests that the school's reputation has declined?
It's some of this is probably inevitable in the sense that there have been a number of other good places, you know, the mm-hmm. field has proliferated in recent years, and places like one of the things is I think that Wisconsin, there's accreditation is one reason. Another reason is that Wisconsin faculty are not as active in AEJ mm-hmm. and as they were. Either in leadership positions mm-hmm. or in research or in the divisions, and I think so. Therefore, they tend to be. A lot of Wisconsin graduates are very active in AEJ, mm-hmm. but not the Wisconsin faculty. And I think for some very good reasons, in part because I think of the intellectual decline of AEJ. I think AEJ is no longer the kind of intellectual force in the field that it was, and so you have
that could be. You know, that's kind of a double-edged sword.
Because if
the faculty withdraw from it, it may be greater participation,
sure.
but it would raise the level.
I know, for instance, our colleague Jim Bachman, I mean, he's become very disillusioned about AEJ. Mm-hmm. Well, he doesn't go and is not active in it, so therefore, Wisconsin is not as visible in that area, you know, in the same way with other people, too.
Yeah.
And so... That sort of thing. Another thing that's happened too, I think, is the fact that school here, and I think this is true of other schools as well, that that they are less involved with the media, less mm-hmm. actively involved in the media, mm-hmm. and there's been a clear decline there. This is mm-hmm. one thing that Bud felt very strongly about, that school of journalism has to have heavy involvement with the local state media, and even in a national sense.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly, schools of journalism have been pulling back from that. For instance, one of the things that Ralph started and Bud continued was called the Institutes Program. We call it Journalism Institutes, mm-hmm. where we would have some kind of a program, intellectual program of current issues in the,
mm-hmm.
and then invite editors, broadcasters, and so forth around the state to participate in that. And that was in the time we gave the Distinguished Service Awards.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And for instance, there might be something on the coming election. So like if you have one before election, then we'd bring in people from the university that who are expert on politics and electoral procedures in the, mm-hmm. in the state, and we'd talk, you know, and involve the editors. Well, we no longer do this. You know.
How? What are the other things that Bud did to try to connect the school with media?
Well, I think that there was always an effort to try to, and Ralph had done this too, was try to look for ways that there could be some kind of research,
mm-hmm.
research that would be of help to the local media, to the media,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I know Ralph had started the Minnesota Poll at the University of Minnesota, which was carried by the Star and Tribune. It was a poll for the whole state of Minnesota, and it covered all the issues, politics as well as public issues. Well, that's the kind of thing that the Star and Tribune carried it, and that was a way of having some kind of input with the mm-hmm. media. Well, and I think Ralph had hoped that the Mass Communication Research Center, which Jack headed and Steve was actively involved in. The thing of it was, that Steve and Jack were not interested in that kind of research. That was seen as applied research, very low level in their mm-hmm. kinds of priorities,
mm-hmm.
and they were interested in other things that included other kinds of communication research that did not, that...
It always
so
threatening.
And there were a number of times where we tried to get this going, but it never really worked.
It always struck me that, going back to Blyer, if I understood Blyer correctly, he was interested or saw the school as a kind of bridge between research at the university and the media and the press.
Yeah.
And in a sense helped, it was a way of explaining the research mm-hmm. to a broader public. And is this, I don't know, this I think is true maybe in all fields, that all fields have become more specialized over the years,
mm-hmm.
and people begin to get focused on very narrow issues, and they tend to lose, sight of trying to communicate what that means
mm-hmm.
in a larger sense.
Yeah, right.
And maybe what you're describing here is part of a larger problem
mm-hmm.
that the university has had, but at the same time, it's an opportunity for journalism.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the political science department, they've got the La Follette Institute, in many ways does that kind of does research and
mm-hmm.
involvement in broader, but also sort of more specific political problems
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Within Wisconsin. I suppose law schools could be an example too, where law schools do law reviews and so forth. They involve themselves with what's going on in the
mm-hmm.
In the field in ways that could be comparable to journalism. But I think that that's been a problem generally in journalism education, of becoming, there used to be a much closer relationships between the media, but there again, you can see it's also as a reflection of the fact that schools of journalism are involved in other things besides relations with the newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Now there were efforts in Minnesota and here too to have sessions for broadcasters, but then you got advertising and public relations and how you bring those people in too. And so we used to try to do that, but I think that one of the things that's happened, and this is sort of not as meant as a critique, but just as an evolutionary change, that a school like this, while still very good in a lot of in so many ways, including the quality of some of the individuals on the faculty, is the fact that it's become increasingly a social science department of people with various interests, mm-hmm. Concerns and so forth are much like those of other academic departments at the university. It's less a school of journalism than mm-hmm. In the Bleier model. But this is also reflects the fact that this is a research university, and it's very hard to run a school of journalism, the Bleier model, in a research university where the rewards for teaching, for research, for advancement and so forth, are related to research that often has little or nothing to do with preparing students for jobs in journalism or public service. I think the whole, one of the things under Bleier, and I mean under Bud and Ralph too, was the public service idea, that mm-hmm. public service was defined as working with the media, mm-hmm. and not even particularly like working with the public, but working with the media. Well, that is pretty much gone from the school, but also the university as a whole, it doesn't, mm-hmm. The extension takes care of that. And so that's another thing that's contributed to this change so you have faculty, who feel no particular need to go to the social, one thing, for instance, that Bud and the faculty did, and when I was director too, you went to their meetings. Mm-hmm. You went to the meetings of the AP or the Wisconsin Press Association, or the weekly editors when they had a separate organization, and you participated and you socialized with these guys. Mm-hmm. Well, this doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
And that's another sort of indicator of the changed relationship of the school. And here, for a faculty member, what are the rewards? It's research.
Yeah.
And that's where the pay will come. That's where the grants and so forth you get will.
Yeah. I still think the Bleier model is sound in many ways, because what we're trying to do, even though we're dealing with more with than just print journalists, mm-hmm. You're really dealing with people who work. You're really dealing with people who work in media, whether they're television or PR or whatever.
That's right.
And the goal they're trying to prepare them. I think tape looks like it's got. A few more things about Bud in terms mm-hmm. of his. Another. Okay, you were talking about Bud's legacy and leadership, and you had some more comments you wanted to add about that.
I was going to say that, and I've talked about this with Bud. I think that the Bleier model contains the seeds of its own decline within it, because the fact that Bleier brought the journalism education, the importance of research and the intellectual study of communication and all, and as a result of him as a result of his influence, you had a number of schools that became very receptive, as Chafee and Rogers point out, very receptive to the study of communication in the broad sense, and with the emphasis on research that came from Bleier and did not come out of the Missouri tradition, which was the other sort of the main tradition in journalism education, that you had an increasing concern with education. With research, and less with preparing of journalists, of students for jobs in journalism. And the thing about research and PhD thing, research, and this is true all through the university, professor who's training graduate students, he's training students in his own image. He's not training them for to be newspaper men, and so that you more and more are turning out PhDs who are communication researchers and not journalism professors. And so then these guys, when they leave, they don't want to teach begin recording.
Okay, this is a new tape. Let's try.
Build in obsolescence in those things.
Okay. Well, we have a new tape recorder, and the other one gave out, and I'm assuming that it's recording, but I have no way to review it, so we'll just continue on here.
Okay.
We were talking about... What were we talking about?
Well, we were talking about the Blyer model contained the seeds of its own...
That's right.
...own destruction. And I was going to say that there's a good example of this is Percy Tannenbaum, Bud probably talked about him. Great character, marvelous guy, marvelous personality. But Percy, Ralph had later said that he thought that Percy was his biggest mistake of somebody he hired. And Percy came with a PhD from Illinois and had been at Michigan State. Because Percy didn't believe in journalism education. And when he later went to Berkeley, he tried to get rid of the Department of Journalism at Berkeley. But in any case,
why didn't he believe in that? What was
He believed in communication, and he was a intellectual, and I mean, he didn't like newspapers or didn't like newspapermen. He was a Canadian, which I don't know, maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe it was his innate anti-Americanism.
Yeah.
But in any case, while here on the faculty, Ralph was trying to get him together with the state journal, Don Anderson of the State Journal, and Ebu of the Cap Times to have some collaborative research or things like leadership or whatever to help the newspaper. But Percy would have nothing to do with it. And also Percy at one time, while Ralph was still director, this is sort of rare in academia, he personally tried to start another department. And he wanted to start another department, of sort of a communication department, because it listed people like Len Berkowitz, social psychology, Bernie Cohen, get these guys to help get them to join and start a department of their own. Well, Ralph was a very, very sharp guy. He was an administrator. Cut this down. But it was also seen as a very disloyal thing for Tannenbaum to be doing. I don't think anyway, the thing was, people like that were the two of the people who the girls in school were not willing to play by the ground.
Bud.